At Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr, we're all about celebrating the journey of life and leadership, no matter what stage you're at. And that's where our partners at Standard Life come in. For decades, Standard Life have been helping people navigate life's most important transitions, from planning your financial future to embracing the opportunities that come with a new chapter in life. Whether you're starting your career or nearing retirement, Standard Life is there. Working with financial advisors, they help you plan for your life journey and do it with confidence. Because getting you ready for your best second life involves financial planning, but it's also about making sure you're ready to live it well. So wherever you are at in your life or career, let Standard Life help you plan for tomorrow while enjoying today. Visit standardlife.ie to find out more about planning for your best second life. Standard Life International DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
Now, my guest today on Life and Leadership is the tech entrepreneur Ray Nolan. He's had staggering success. He founded HostelWorld.com, growing it into a global leader before its sale in 2009. He launched Excelco, offering e-commerce solutions, Ultimate Rugby, the leading rugby app, and many, many more tech businesses. He's also had great success with Skyscanner. Starting with Raven Computing at 22, Ray has built multiple successful tech businesses, and he joins me now in a place that means a lot to him, in Malahide Rugby Club. Good morning to you, Ray. How are you?
Hey, Bobby, great to be here, and welcome to sunny Malahide.
Yeah, well, firstly, we better set the scene as to where we are. We're in Malahide Rugby Club. I think it's a club that you had a playing career with, and you still have a strong association with. It's right here on the estuary, and we're sitting here in the, I suppose it's the president's bar or the function room, per se, overlooking, on a beautiful sunny morning, overlooking Malahide Estuary. And I know Malahide is a place of your roots, so tell us a little bit more about your early days. We don't know much about you. We know your father was a vet, and that you lived in Malahide, but there's more we want to know.
Yeah, I guess that's why you're here. I think we arrived in Malahide when I was about six. I lived here till I was about 16 or 17, and then went out on my own, scattered around the south side just to see what it was like. But, you know, here, I mean, Malahide's an amazing place. I'm very privileged to live here. Grew up in semi-D suburbia, like everybody else in Malahide, frankly. But, like, you're looking out on the estuary there, went sailing there all the summers. We've got tennis down the road. We all tennis, rugby, you know, the sports.
It's kind of a village
here,
in the country, isn't it?
And an unbelievable guy club, obviously. Sylvester's in the heart of the village with a great bar and so on. Gibney's famous, beautiful boozer. It's a good place to grow up for kids, and privileged to be here.
Yeah, great. You went, you did your leaving cert at 16. You went off to DIT, as it was in those days, Kevin Street, to do electrical or electronic engineering. I'm not sure which, maybe both. But I gather you didn't really enjoy college. Is that right?
Not sure if I was there that often to love it or hate it, to be honest with you. I mean, I did my leaving at 16. Just put that in context. You know, I was in school at the age of three, right? So you're ahead. Remember that book Outliers, where the best kids are born in January, and are sort of six going into school, and they'll always be the biggest in their class and the best at sports. Reverse that to a kid who's born in October and goes to school at the age of three, and therefore is always the youngest, possibly smallest in the class. And then when you do your leaving at 16, you're picking your subjects at 14.
Yeah.
So you can't even tie your laces at 14. Couldn't tie your laces at 16. Ended up pretty much being told, given no choice, but like, you've half an inkling about maths, go and do engineering. I still don't know what engineers do, and I don't intend to ever know what they do. I spent many years in Kevin Street, a fine establishment, in the bar. I think I did 6 years there in total and came out with a diploma, which isn't... And I can't wire a plug. My missus won't let me near anything electrical in the house. I have no talent in that regard.
When did you start writing code?
At about 17 or 18.
Okay. So yeah, that was something you were doing even when you were in college?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a computer game and sold it for not very much, but it was a good sort of illustration, if you like, of the desire. I mean, programming is a wonderful, wonderful environment to be in. It was very hard in the early days because you were working off tapes and all kinds of crap that went wrong, and the computers had very little memory and so on. But moving on I taught myself programming, taught myself coding the whole way through college. The only time I ever was really in Kevin Street was to get computer time. Yeah. But mostly taught myself and became okay at it. Famously, actually, I'll give you a good story about my final year project in Kevin Street, which I can attest to now because I've no degree worth the paper. I've no degree. But there was a project that I had which was to do time recording, like clocking in and clocking out effectively on a PC, right? Yeah. But PCs were expensive. They were $4,000 or $5,000 each. So a company wouldn't spend $4,000 or $5,000 on a clocking system. So I wrote this thing that you plug the yoke into the back of the PC and it ran a little pin code time clocking system, but the PC could still be used for everything else. So it was a very ingenious way of doing things. The only issue was the hardware never worked. I could never get the thing to do. So my final day comes up and I've got to present my project to the luminaries in the college. And of course, the hardware has never worked, but one lecturer had seen a light come on somewhere on my device. So I said, look, I'm going to convince him that he saw it working at one stage. And I put 220 volts through a 12-volt circuit, blew the shite out of it. But the good news is that the software was brilliant. And it was fine. It did payroll and it printed out your check and so on. So I managed to bluff my way through it. It didn't get me through that year. I think I still failed one exam.
Had you one eye on the world of business when you were in college? I know you set up Raven Computing. You were only 22 years of age. So you must have been just either in college or just post-college.
Had I one eye of business? I kind of never had a job. I once got a start, in fairness, a contract with Smurfit Computing, of all people, based on my leaving results, because I still hadn't finished my final year in college because I hadn't passed anything. So they gave me a start, and basically I walked in and they threw me a computer manual for a language I'd never even looked at. And started blasting my way through it, and within fairly quick time I was pretty good at it, and I realized pretty early, even at that age, I was probably 20, that coding, you know, there's quite a lot of mundanity to writing code, and you work on the smart stuff, not all the stuff. So I wrote a code generator that managed to do most of my work before 10 o'clock in the morning, and the rest of the time I just fart around, you know. And I was lucky then I went to Saudi with them, and I went to Saudi again on my own, just helping out. Worked with Almarai Milk, do you remember the Irish company out in Mastock, Saudi?
Yeah.
Worked there for a few months at a time.
The McGuckian family, was it?
Yeah.
Mastock, yeah.
Yeah,
good. You seem to have always operated multiple things and multiple businesses at the same time. You founded a company called Core Time back in the early days. I think it was later sold to Sage. Mm-hmm. You've said also that you found HR is difficult to make money out of.
Yeah, so Core Time, obviously, I mean, so my sort of role, my route through business in the early days was, you know, writing one-off jobs for small companies.
Yeah.
And then quickly realizing if you sell time, you can only sell 24 hours a day. I would say, unless you're a lawyer, in which case you bill 48 hours in the same day and no one ever asks you why. But Core Time was a time and billing product for accountants, engineers, etc., and architects, anybody who sells time, we'd all record our time on the job, and it would, you know, manifest itself.
Billable hours,
yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, that was written in 1992 and was sold again. It was sold to Sage 2003 and was sold again 2 years ago. So it's still going. And that's that's quite cool. And in fact, the Barristers of Ireland is another product. So it moved from writing one-off jobs to writing products, because you could then sell the same product 20 times. The Barristers of Ireland still use a product called Breeze, which I wrote in 1990. That's 35 years. I'd like to know how many software guys are out there whose product is still live
or
and kicking.
How much billable hours have gone out on your software.
Yeah.
In terms of Raven Core Time, when did Hostel World come about, or how did it come about?
Yeah, the genesis of Hostel World, I don't think it's ever been told in its entirety, but very briefly, because you're kind of, I'm like a chipmunk, I'd always have my head up looking for opportunities and anything. And someone, do you remember Aircom once changed the billing mechanism for a phone call from being 15 or 5p for a phone call to being 5p for 3 minutes. And the world went crazy for it. It was just a disaster. You know, Mrs. Nolan was up in arms about the bill now being bigger than it was. So I wrote this thing, which was telephone cost management. It was more for business. It wasn't for homes. But it was, remember the old PABXs? Everybody had a phone on their desk. Imagine, I don't even have a phone on my desk anymore. But so when you made a call, you dialed +1 212, la, la, la. At the PABX would print out a line of print at the end of that phone call on a printer, and it would show who made what calls. And so what we did is we took the printer out of the scenario, plugged a cable into the back of the PC, back to my old engineering project. It's like this one I didn't blow up. And we took the data that would go to the printer and put it into a piece of software, and then was able to say extension 25 keeps ringing his cousin in Australia, which was a big thing in business, right? You always made your calls on the boss's clock, and you were doing telephone cost management. Ironically, telephone cost management was hot for a period of time, but when we were selling it, it was always the boss or the manager who was buying the product would say, I want my number off that list. It was quite funny, you know? So roll on then. I put this thing into place. It was reasonably successful. There was one competitor, I think, in Ireland at the time. And then I went into one place that was a hotel. And again, hotels had the same thing. There was a line of print. And when room 24 checked out, they went down and looked at all the calls, room 24, and tried to work out by hand what the call costs were. And obviously, robbed you blind, but that was the way it was. And so one hotelier said, look, if you've got 24 there, would you not like be able to put on the software? Can I not put in the name of the guy who's in the room? So Mr. Nolan comes down and I go, Mr. Nolan, how are you? Room 24, and your telephone bill is calculated for you. And I said, yeah, fair enough. He says, well, could you not put Mr. Nolan into the room? Like, could you not book him into the room and that he's in from Monday to Wednesday? And I said, yeah, I suppose we could do that too. So roll on from telephone cost management to hotel software. We ended up doing hotels, small hotels. Ironically, and through no fault of mine, several of them burnt down, which is probably a good thing because hotels were hard to work for.
Yeah.
And then rolled forward from that, one of the hoteliers had hostels. And he said, can we use your hotel software in our hostel? And I said, no way, it won't work. Because in a hostel, there are 300 beds. They all have different portfolios. They're all checking out on different days. They're sharing rooms. There are girls' dorms and boys' dorms. There are mixed dorms. And I said, look, I'll write something new and brilliant for hostels. So I wrote a hostel software product for that. So, you know, you wouldn't have thought you'd come from working at the cost of a phone call to Australia to putting bodies into Australia. But that's...
You've described the hostel booking game as the bottom of the barrel in a bottom feeding industry, which is...
I can't believe I said something that negative. It must have been just after we sold.
But in terms of, this was frontier stuff. You were coming up with a new product in a relatively, fairly new industry, a new way of doing business, huge disruption, and, you know, new process, new systems, and clicked. And then not only did it click, then you were able to grow it to being like a serious scalable business.
Yeah, I think, look, I started it in 1999. So we roll on from hostels software in the hostel, and then the web comes along, and I said, look, let's connect the web to that product that has the spare beds, and we'll sell those beds. So Hostel World came out of Raven, all those companies, kind of the journey goes on. And so we connected Hostel World to the my old software product and started selling beds. It was a really exciting time. But the web was new and nascent, but obviously everybody had just blown up or very soon to blow up. 2000 wasn't a great time for being in .com. People had just blown hundreds of millions on crack.
Yeah.
So we couldn't raise money. Not even thought about raising money, actually. It wasn't even on the agenda. But
in hindsight, that was probably a good thing, was it?
Oh,
because you didn't give away any of the
equity. See, I've always run proper businesses. I mean, I know I'm a .com guy, and therefore you assume that I piss away money on a daily basis on, you know, helicopters and things like that to flow banners over rugby pitches. That's not true. Like, I run businesses for profit.
Yeah.
And so I've never celebrated a fundraise. I'm not sure if I've ever even fundraised for myself. Maybe I have once or twice. But, so it was a proper business from day one.
Yeah.
So we started selling beds. We're very quickly, because we had hostels using this offer, we're very quickly in the UK, then New York, then France, then ironically Tel Aviv, because I was on a jolly, a government jolly with Core Time, and I happened to be running Hostel World at the same time, and I said, I'll pop into a few hostels while I'm in Tel Aviv, and I went into Tel Aviv. We had hostels there. But it took on. But the reason why was probably because of the business model. The software was brilliant, but the business model was insane and it never had been done and has been since reused time and time again. We weren't going into you saying, let me sell your beds. Give me some credit, because I've got to get the money so I can pay you.
Yeah.
And then, so the circle of payment was, you know, customer books hostel with travel agent. Customer stays in hostel. Travel agent sends bill, or hostel sends bill to travel agent. Travel agent remits the money to the hostel. But sure, if there's only 20 quid involved,
yeah,
and the commission is 2 quid, sure, the cost of the stamps alone would have broken you. So what we said was, look, we'll give you software to help you run your business for free. Now, that was a big give, because that software we used to charge 10 and 20 grand for.
Yeah.
You're the hostel. We're going to give you this software for nothing, and you will give us beds to sell. And if we sell them, we'll take 10% at point of booking. So you'll see people booking hostels online now, and they'll pay 10% down or 15% down now.
That goes straight to the software.
Hostel World keeps that money.
Yeah.
So it's perceived as a deposit, but it's actually a technology charge. And then the beauty for the hostel is they collect the balance on your arrival. So the circle of collecting money is gone.
Yeah.
So that big and tedium of chasing $2 around the world doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
So hostels really adopted very quickly. It wasn't that hard to sell, because I was never going to owe you money. I was giving you something that was going to make you more efficient, and I was going to sell your beds.
Yeah. So and did you know that at the time, or was it a hard sell to convince, you know, hostel operators that this was, or was it so simple in its delivery that they got it day one?
We were taking people. I mean, there were no hostel systems bar my one, right, that ran hostels in place around the world at the time, but like the original hostel software, they were running off paper or spreadsheets.
Yeah.
And so if you imagine you call a hostel and you say, I'd like to stay Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and you talk to Ray at reception, and Ray takes out the diary and he goes, yeah, room 4, bed 5. I write you in on the 15th, and I turn the page, I write you in the 16th, write you in the 17th on that bed every day. Problem is, Ray calls, he says, I'm not going to make it. I'm still in Dubrovnik and I'm on the piss. I'm not going to make it. What does Ray do at reception? Or the receptionists do, he rubs you out for day one, but he doesn't rub you out for day two and day three.
And then
the hostel thinks it's full, but it's not full.
Yeah.
That guy's never going to show. He'd never given you a deposit. There was no deposit or booking relationship. It was just basically, yes, I'll come. You know?
Yeah. And in terms of scaling the business up, then I know you did some acquisitions. You bought some other booking engines.
Mm.
Was that part of the play to get it to the, whatever it was, 500 million valuation?
It was never 500. It was nearly a billion, Bobby.
Yeah.
We just sold it on the downslope. we did buy a few things, but they were small in the scheme of things. The business built itself. We bought hostels.com in a fairly bold move. We bought a domain name for $3.75 million when people wouldn't pay $50 for a domain name. We went out and spent that, and we had no money to buy it. And that business, we were very good at defending our territory. When you've got a monopoly, it's eventually going to go away. That's business. Monopolies, people see opportunity, they'll come in against you. But we defended really, really well.
Yeah.
And so if there was an opportunity to take something, we would have, by buying hostels.com, because we were hostelworld.com, hosteleverycountryintheworld.com, Hostel Europe, Hostel USA, Hostel America, Hostel Planet, Hostel Universe, I think we bought that. And then the hostels.com was a threat. If someone bought hostels.com, they have an immediate brand.
Of course they do.
So we said, right, we better get ahead of that. We bought it. It was fortuitous, because I think the year that we bought hostels.com, we made $3.75 million, almost at a penny, coincidentally, out of that domain name.
Amazing. And, yeah. And so from 98 to, it was a relatively short tenure in terms of your own involvement when you look at how long it generally takes. So you were in and out
10 years.
Yeah, 10 years is, that's short.
You're a coffee guy. It takes you a lot longer. Us.com guys, we like to get out pretty
short. And no, like nothing happens in 10 years. It takes most people 20.
Yeah.
But one of the things I admire about you is that you seem to be able to spin a lot of plates at the same time. And again, that's a dark art.
Well, I'm still a coder, and I'm still intensely interested in creating stuff. I think, I mean, you know, software is a, like I've said, is a beautiful space, but it has been maligned. The idea that someone in software was a sandal wearing geek who spent all his time in his room on his own, and when he wasn't on YouPorn, he was doing a bit of coding. You know what I mean? That's not the truth. The truth is, we're outgoing lads who meet people and have girlfriends and beautiful wives. And sometimes we have husbands and so on as well, you know. So it was really, you know, I have an interest in creating things. And
do you feel then again that every business then should change, you know, massively over a period of a number of years? In other words, you have to keep reinventing the business to stay relevant.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing. If you're not reinventing yourself and looking for opportunities to reinvent yourself, someone's going to eat your lunch.
Yeah.
I mean, this is why Apple is still there, because it's moved from being a PC-esque maker to being Apple phones, iPads. Now, their real business now is I've got your credit card. I'm now going to sell you whatever I can sell you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so they constantly sought to reinvent. And so did we. You know, even in hostel world, when you say, well, we were selling hostels. No, we were moved on. We tried to sell hotels. We got into vacation rental. We created Boo.com, which when we sold, they pulled the plug on it. But I'm telling you now, if Boo.com was alive, it'd be by some margin one of the bigger players in online travel, because it was trying to do things that weren't being done.
You talk about, you know, drive. You talk about looking for opportunity. Where does luck and where does timing come into it?
People like to use the word luck a lot, don't they?
Well, what do you, is it a word you don't like?
I don't think so. I think you make your own luck. But I think if you're not on the pitch, you're never going to score. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we would always, I am a risk taker, not a phenomenal risk taker, but I will have a shot at things. And if by dint of the fact that I put a bet on that it won means that I'm lucky, well, if you didn't put a bet on, you weren't lucky, but you didn't try.
Yeah.
You know? So I would tend to look out for opportunities, and to the extent that I have the energy, I'll try and have a poke at them. And I'm pretty quick to see whether something is working or whether there's a sense that it might work, and maybe backing away or changing it pretty quickly as well.
And in terms of your appetite for risk, is that still there, or does that diminish when you get a few successes and you don't really have to bet the house anymore? Does your appetite for risk automatically diminish?
So interestingly, risk, taking a chance, taking a shot at something. You know, I was the Grand Hotels up the road actually recently sold a great man, Matt Ryan, who probably educated half of Malahide young boys on how to work in bars and so on. We all learned, and working in a bar is something that's close to my heart, because I feel everybody should see what someone coming in the door looks like and how they handle themselves when they go out. But I was a very good barman when I was down there, and I remember saying to myself, I don't have to succeed at anything, because I'll always have food on my table.
Yeah.
And so I really never really thought, I knew I was unemployable, I was never going to get another job, like a proper job, because, you know, if I was to have gotten a job, if something had failed on me and I was to have to go back out to the workplace, everybody would have known by my demeanor that I was really just holding turf for a few weeks until I thought of another idea and I was gone again. So you wouldn't hire me. I wouldn't have hired me, you know. But have I set aside for risk? Yeah, I think it's a great time to be in business. I think it's a great time to be, I mean, as a software guy, AI is pretty insane, and, you know, the opportunities within it are huge too. And maybe that this is the chance for us as software people to actually deliver on the efficiencies and the crack. Remember, we were all going to work 2 days a week and put our feet up. That's what, when PCs came out and email was going to be brilliant, that never happened.
No.
It just became torrid muck.
Yeah.
And so now maybe AI gets people the freedom to think and enjoy themselves, and maybe we will end up in 2 days a week and bring it on.
Yeah.
You know?
I was going to ask you about AI maybe a bit later, but are we overexcited about AI? Is it going to make that much difference?
We're underexcited about it.
Right.
We're underexcited. I mean, all the boring things that you do, I mean, there are certain manual labor things that we'll never be able to replace. I'm not sure that you can cut a hedge, like, cost effectively with AI, but or valet a car or
lay a
whatever
brick.
Else. Or,
yeah.
Lay a brick. I'll take that back. I mean, the Chinese are
already doing
3D printing houses,
yeah.
And they're doing a great job. And in fact, I saw there was some done in Ireland recently. But it just solves the, I call it the blank page problem. Like, if you've got, oh geez, I've got to start something, you just start with a simple prompt into ChatGPT, and sort of that'll help you get there, and then tease your way through it. It's not going to give you the answer now, but it's, it will get you the tedious hours done, and then you refine it. You know, I'm not saying that I'd ever publish something that I got back from ChatGPT now. Will you ever? I don't know. I think I can, currently I can recognize stuff that's been ChatGPT generated or AI generated. I can pretty much always recognize it. But in time, you can imagine.
That should get better.
Yeah.
It should get slicker.
But it should be, like, genuinely, we should embrace it because it's going to make life easier.
Yeah.
It's already making life easier. And if you're not using it, then maybe you should have a poke at it, because it's not a threatening thing to use. It's a plain English command. And the thing about it is, remember, it's ChatGPT, not one prompt GPT.
Yeah.
So you ask it a question and then you say, well, that's not what I wanted. Refine that and you know, do something else.
No, you can drill down. And it's a great noise eliminator in the sense that you can burrow through.
There's hallucinations too. It gets it wrong all the time.
Yeah.
You called it Excel, we call ourselves eDesk now, but eDesk does the best customer service software platform online. And we've got great AI built in and so on. But I remember we were beta testing some of our AI stuff with a company in the US that do car parts, $1 billion sales every year. But so someone writes in and says, like, how do I fit the tow bar? This tow bar doesn't fit on my Ford Capri. And ChatGPT wrote back, no problem, sir, we'll send you a new car. So it makes mistakes. Thankfully, that never got to production. But so it takes a good shot at the title.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
Let's talk about a sort of post-hostel world, a lot of things you do. It's hard to keep up with you. The businesses change names every so often. Is that a strategy about the name changes around?
It's fucking horrible.
Around reinvention?
No, I think name, like branding, am I a marketing guy? I'm nothing. I have no qualifications in anything. You know, I did say when we set up Excelco, it was never Excelco. It was Excel.co, because .co's were going to be hot. And they were for about a week. And then you go, Jesus, I'm after naming this thing. And so over time, and imagine being on the phone and saying, I'm Ray from Excelco. And they go, expel that. You could spend half your time getting through the spelling of the name.
It needs to be.
You know? And like, if you think about good branding and good naming, and you'd be the king of branding, but like, you know, the money you spend on a bad brand is half as effective as the money you spend on a good brand. If I say eDesk, I'm going to say it many times so your listeners will hear it, eDesk.com, you will remember it, and you probably guess how to spell it.
Well, I never get these kind of weird, funky names that are, you know, an F and a T together and all this.
Yeah.
And you're meant to work it out.
Yeah.
And then somebody gets your email wrong and they don't know where you are. And
yeah.
It's just a mess. Like, it's tedious. You shouldn't have to do all that stuff.
Yeah.
It should be crystal clear.
Yeah. I mean, domain names are a bit of my thing. I bought boo.com, which was a failed clothing, one of the most famous internet blow-ups of all time was called boo.com. I was reading the book one day, I said, oh Jesus, I wonder where that domain name is now, and I bought it, and we tried to do something cool with it. But I do believe in spending time thinking about your brand name.
Yeah.
And if you have to bite the bullet, it's awfully expensive to do it, to change the name, and particularly with the internet where your legacy clicks, links, you know, you'll say that on your bios with your podcast links, and so you say, this is right from eDesk. If you change his name, that you're not going to go back and change it for me. So all that link juice is burnt.
Yeah.
So change your name in an online world is a pretty expensive and risky thing to do.
So tell us about eDesk. Where is it at now?
So we do, like I say, primarily customer support. We call it customer engagement now because we do pre-sale engagement. So you'll be on a site and you'll go, have you got those in blue? And because we're connected to the inventory, we'll be able to see that, yes, we have got them in blue and we have them in a size 12 and so on. And so we do pre-sales chat, and then we do post-sale customer support. It's all AI powered. It's obviously human beings are involved periodically. You want to get the easy stuff. Like, for example, a big thing in online e-commerce is Wizmo. Where's my order? Wizmo.
Yeah.
And we know the answers to the question. So if you go, I ordered my shoes on Tuesday, when will they arrive? That's a Wizmo. And our system goes, well, here's Bobby. He ordered shoes on Friday and they were shipped on Saturday and they'll arrive on Tuesday. And so we send you, here's your link to the tracking code, and no human being is involved at all. And that can be up to 35% of all incoming queries.
Is there a customer that would maybe be selling on Amazon, on a number of the platforms, and you kind of collate?
Yeah, so we consolidate all the support into one place, and that's our big thing, really, because if you're selling on Amazon and eBay and your own website and you're doing some stuff on TikTok and you get some reviews on Twitter or some incoming noise on Twitter that you need to get, we put all of the incoming communications into one place, and we throw a bit of AI over the top and make it easy to handle it. You know, we would argue, like, we're in AI, I love the lads in Intercom, they're Irish and God bless them, albeit American company, so we shouldn't forget that, because I'm an Irish company. Our AI smokes theirs, because we've been doing it for 5 or 6 years, and we've got, you can't AI data you don't have, and so we have the order data, we have the shipping data, we have lots of the AI solutions out there don't have the connectivity to the information. And so you can't say your shoes shipped Friday because you're not connected to the shipping system that said they were shipped on Friday.
So what's the end game here for iDesk?
For eDesk?
That was deliberate, Bobby.
Look, we support 25 billion. We did 25 billion in sales last year. I say we did. We supported 25 billion in sales for our customers last year.
It's a big business.
We use a lot of technology to make that. So people-wise, we're still sub 100. But our ambition would definitely be to get to 100 billion in supported transactions in the next couple of years. I think that, the beauty about that is that, we've evidenced that our software is doing a smashing job all the way through. First of all, it's always been run as a business. It's profitable. We haven't raised any money. Even Ray Nolan hasn't dumped a shit ton of cash into it. Excuse my French. And so we're profitable. We make money. We're not beholden to a VC or a PE guy or, that kind of stuff. We run it like a proper business. And sometimes companies raise money, and this is probably a downtime for valuations on business, on SaaS businesses, because people are learning. Because so many people raised 50, 60, 100 million and burnt it acquiring customers at a price they could never earn that money back. Whereas we've always paid what the customer is worth to us and no more. So we try to make sure that every relationship with every customer is good for both sides.
Isn't it interesting when you look at some of the technology businesses now that, that you can really develop a huge business with so few employees?
Yeah, and there's talk of people, I can build a unicorn with one person and so on. Look, you certainly can do things with many, many less people. And you can get to a place where you can prove out something. I'd be big into trying something out and getting it to market quickly. That's not MVP bullshit that startup people like to talk about. It's like deliver a great product as quickly as you can and learn as many lessons as you can without sort of gilding the lily. Let's get it out. And if there's a great acronym I claim to have invented. It was TAGPTH. So what does TAGPTH mean? If we end up writing a piece of software and we're running on servers, and what happens if we did 100 million orders? That's TAGPTH. These are good problems to have. If we get to 100 million orders, we'll buy bigger servers. We'll sort it out, right? Yeah. But so we're not going to build, a Cray or the biggest computing environment in the world on our first iteration. But we're going to be alert to its growth and know that when it's going to come to end of life or when we need to grow it.
Your interest in rugby found its way into Ultimate Rugby with Brian O'Driscoll. How's that going?
It's not doing too badly. It washes its face. The funny thing about rugby is it's huge here, and we're in the middle of Six Nations, so it's very huge here, and I love it dearly, and I've loved the engagement with rugby because it's a passion of mine anyway. But apart from UK, Ireland, France, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, you're not going to get a huge audience. Yeah. And so people talk about, why are soccer players paid so much and rugby players don't get paid so much? Just not as many eyeballs on them.
Yeah.
So there's not many people buying the jersey, and it all comes down to that optics, So it washes its face. It doesn't make a ton of money. It doesn't lose money, despite the fact some journalists like to reach out for some crazy numbers that it's losing money. It's washing its face.
Yeah.
And could it do a lot more? Yes. Is it my focus in life? No. It's mostly run out of Cape Town and South Africa now, although a few young fellas in the greater Malahide area have thrown their oar at it over time and scored matches and so on, but mostly it's run out of Cape Town.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple of turkeys along the way. What about Worky.com?
Easily, whatever happened easily there? The best software that was ever written. You know, it's funny. It was. I still hanker after it. It was supposed to be what I call LinkedIn for ordinary people.
Yeah.
And you learn your mantras around businesses when you're promoting them. But the idea being that, you know, you, Bobby, you've a reason to have a network, okay? But if I'm a barman in the Grand Amal of Hyde, I don't need a network, but I need somewhere to put my CV and be out there. And there's many people have tried this, by the way. And Workee was a version of that. It was kind of what I called it, LinkedIn for ordinary people that didn't need a network kind of thing. It was phenomenal. But we did launch it into the worst recession the world had ever had in 2009, 2010, when the only job that mattered to the HR person was
her own. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so if I walked into a company, and many of them came and we showed it, and I would go to the CEO and go, you got to try Workee.com. You can type in this query and you can find 20 programmers tomorrow. What do you think the HR person said the minute she saw it or he saw it? Well, we make sure this isn't going to work. Because
yeah.
My budget that used to be 200 grand a year for recruitment fees is now 20 grand to pay Workee.com. And so I no longer report to the CEO. I'm now a level down. And so, look, at I mean, that's an exaggeration. But it's a hard world selling to HR. I mean, we've got HR people in eDesk, and daily someone's trying to sell them something. It's a very yeah. hard space to be
and
in.
You talk about timing there.
Yeah.
That might it have worked at another time?
I believe so.
Yeah.
I believe so. I think there's stuff out there right now. I mean, we were very much like Indeed at one stage. There was a company, Indeed and Simply Hired were beside each other in terms of their model of showing jobs to people. We were effectively the same as Simply Hired. It didn't work then. Did I fall out of love with the industry? Yeah, I like stuff that I don't like enterprise sales. I like stuff that I show it to you. You like it? Cool. You don't like it? Cool. The relationship ends there. And back to my very early days of selling software to barristers in Ireland, I used to love selling software in Limerick and in Cork, particularly Limerick. If you showed a barrister in Cork or in Limerick the software, he'd tell you there and then, I don't want it. And you go, great, you've saved me 400 phone calls.
Yeah.
I can move on. A Dublin fella will say, I really like it. Give me a shout in a few months.
Yeah.
And you'd ruin your life trying to chase down this sale because he wouldn't have the honesty or maybe the balls to say, it's not for me or I can't afford it.
Which brings me to another subject, which is integrity in business, Ray. In leadership in business, you really live and die by the shake of a hand. Would you agree with that?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell you now that, and this was a thing even in Hosterworld days when we'd say, like, oh, we're growing really well. So I would prefer to make less money and not be walking down Grafton Street and have someone with a knife in my back, you know, and we would live and die by it. The opportunities, particularly in Hosterworld times, because it's a funny one, is we invented online travel reviews. Which was just at around the same time Trustpilot came out, or what's the other one, not Trustpilot?
TripAdvisor.
TripAdvisor, yeah.
Yeah.
But we got, because hostels didn't have ratings, I was flying home one day, I said, we've got to find a way to get these guys rated because people are asking for, like, does it have a fire rating? And I was like, geez, I'm not going visiting hostels. What we'll do is we'll get the punters to rate the hostels. So we asked them 5 questions on an email after they'd left the hostel saying, rated for security, location, fun, etc., etc. And but by dint of that rate, because we were doing millions of ratings a year for hostels, if anyone fell below 50, we dropped them off the system.
Yeah.
Because it's clearly shite, your product's rubbish. But then you'd have hostels trying to bribe me with, you know, what about a little tickle here? And then we go, no. And you see, we'd find that there were, look, clearly the last 10 ratings from your own staff. Hostels were making bookings in their own hostel and rating their own hostels to get them back up above the threshold.
Yeah.
So, yeah integrity is, there's just no point in being in business if you're not going to play that game.
Okay, just a couple of things, Ray. What's next for Ray Nolan? You've been involved in what? 3 billion worth of exits? Is that the number or somewhere close?
Yeah, I think it's about 3 billion. I think, but I mean, look, at Skyscanner represented about 1.7 of that. So I've been lucky, I mean, privileged to be involved with lots of really other good businesses. And those businesses aren't businesses that I started, but businesses that I was on the board of or was heavily mentoring or whatever. So, look, am I ever going to stop? I don't know. everything has a price, right? So am I saying that I'm never going to sell this business? I'd be lying to you,
yeah.
Right? Is it actively for sale right now? Not really, but you know, we'll see. But am I going to do something else? Absolutely.
Are you buzzed by the whole deal process? Building something, negotiating the sale, doing the transaction, all that stuff. Do you like that?
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I like being at exit parties particularly. I like a glass of wine. And so, we've had some fairly monumental ones. But no, I prefer the building process. I have to say that one of the things you don't realize when you're building businesses, you know, valuations change. And it's not your valuation. It's the perception in the market of the value of your company, of companies like yours. And people don't take that into account. So, for example, I mean, two or three, Hostelworld was cruising at around $1 billion in 2008 when we failed on an IPO, or 2009 when we pulled our IPO, early 2009. The market had crashed. We were never IPOing. But what was valuing business at 30 times EBITDA was now went down to 15 times EBITDA.
Yeah.
You know, and we had done nothing. We were still growing, but our valuation went in half. SaaS companies 18, 24 months ago were being sold for 10x their revenue. Now you'd be screaming lucky to get 5x your revenue.
So it changes.
You know, and so, you know, you got to be, it's funny, you can do really, really great things, the market around you just changes and you're not getting the reward.
What sort of leader are you, Ray, in terms of, you know, you say you could never have been employed or you never would have got a job anywhere, yet, you know, you're leading all these organizations in your own kind of style. What is your style?
Autocratic ignorance. I'm just saying what other people say. No, I am very, very passionate about what I do. I don't get out of bed to be arsed going to work to just get through the day. And so I'd like it to be right. I love when people exhibit interest in what they do and want to advance for themselves. I have no age bar, nor graduation, nor degree bar on who gets what job or whether they get up the ladder quickly or slowly. I love someone coming to me saying, we were in Hostelworld days, and someone said, look, I just can't get China to work. I think we should be in China. I think it was a 23-year-old girl. I said, why are you standing in front of me?
Yeah.
And she went to China within a week or two and stayed there for 6 or 7 months, built a business out there. So,
you probably don't beat about the bush in terms of your communication.
Direct. Time is precious to me. So I hate Zoom. I frankly hate out of office. Here we go. Here's the pain. We should all be in the office. There you go. I've said it. It's like to do like, you know, work and stuff.
It took you a while to get to that. I thought we would have had that earlier in the conversation.
No, I mean, you know what I really feel for? I feel for the kids.
Yeah.
Because kids, I mean, younger people starting in the workplace. Who are you learning off? You're not learning on a one-hour Zoom meeting with 12 of your colleagues where you're the junior person who was dragged in and you don't even know why you were there. But you know what? You're there, you know. So, you know, I feel for that. And we're going to pay the price in terms of business and growth because of that. Yeah. All businesses are. And it's
even
tedious.
If you look at things like online meetings, sometimes people aren't even bothered putting their cameras on anymore. I'm here, but I'm not here.
That's not to say that I believe that everybody should be in the office every day. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that for sure, you've got a task or something that's on and you go, I need 3 days to just do it on my own. I don't need to be connected to anybody. I just want to get this job done. And there are people whose jobs are just like that and therefore could spend all their time at the office. And in fact, software developers quite often function way better at home where there's no noise. Because I always think about programming as like having 20 spreadsheets open at the same time and knowing where you are in each spreadsheet. And an interruption in that process means you're back half an hour. If someone asks you a stupid question, you're back to finding my place again and trying to understand where I was and my thinking to keep writing. So you don't need interruption. But there's marketing people who need to be with each other and salespeople who need to be going over to a board and going, look at me, I'm at the top of that board. I just made a sale. I want to ring the bell. I want to wear the crown as the best salesperson. So it's horses, of course. And we need to be mature as individuals to say, I understand it. In this business, the marketing people need to be in and the software people don't need to be in as often. You know, and so different.
Yeah. Rather than just everybody going online regardless of what you do.
We are a remote company. Well, you know.
Yeah. And you know, it's the people that find it easier to go on Zoom are maybe the more senior people in the organization.
And you know, the people who are bleeding on, who are the biggest advocates for remote work as like a de facto, let's do remote? the people who are already in their 40s,
yeah.
who have secured their route yeah. to success, they're at pretty much the top of their ladder, and they're going, this works great for me. And of course it works great for you. You can get your hair done, you can do your nails. I nipped out for a game of golf yesterday on my working from home day. I'm going to tell you that now. It took me 2 full hours. So I'm sure I put the hour in later.
Good man.
Really? You know?
A couple of other things I just wanted to ask you to close out. I think I saw somewhere you had advice to your 18-year-old self, and this was that the karma police really exist.
Absolutely.
Not only in the Radiohead song.
Yeah, yeah, I'm a big believer in the karma police, and that is back to the integrity thing. If you do something wrong, you will be caught.
Yeah.
It may not be the same business, the same guy who gets you back, the same girl who gets you back, but you will be caught. And so I think that, and you know what that does? And I've listened to some podcasts recently. You know, if you hold a grudge against someone, it's like you taking poison and hoping they die.
Yeah.
Right? And in the same way, by believing in the karma police, you say, don't worry, he'll be got by somebody
yeah.
else. I'm going to let that go because I have enough things to be going on with in my day than sitting there going, that guy shafted me.
Someone else
will. The karma police will take him. Don't worry.
Yeah, that's good philosophy. And finally then, have you got any examples around leadership that inspired you along the way? Any people, either by way of their style or their persona that
No. Just me. No, I'm only joking. I tell you what, I mean, we're looking out on the glorious Malahide Rugby pitch, and it speaks to, and sport is a wonderful thing, team sport particularly, and I've played in most of the sports in Ireland, so not good, not at any great level. But, you know, someone who, there were captains of teams who drove you into battle, who you went harder because they were going harder.
Yeah.
And you just put your head where you shouldn't have put it because they were putting their heads. And that's that kind of leadership. You see teams, you see, let's say, where Wales have been recently in the Six Nations. They're going out, they're sauntering around the pitch now. They've got a new coach and they were different at the weekend because they were driven to be different. And that's the same in business. You know, you get a leader who clearly believes, who isn't ducking and diving and trying to get you to do something that they don't believe in. Love me or hate me in my office, you know that I believe in what I'm saying and that I'm playing to that standard myself.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not telling you to be great. I'm not telling you to. And by the way, I don't run a world where I expect people to work beyond 9 to 5. I think that's bullshit. Because if I make you work from 9 till 9, and then there's a crisis, well, you don't have the extra hours to give me. So I like you to work from 9 to 5:30. So if there's a crisis, and we don't have crises, so we're okay. But I need to know that you're
if
not.
If there is one, you'll be there.
We don't want you to be burnt. Yeah. We want you to get through your day. So yeah, leadership. For me, I could name names you wouldn't know, and people on the pitch who I played with, who made a material difference. And then in business, I've been so lucky. I've worked with some great leaders. You know, in Skyscanner, we had a great CEO in Gareth Williams, who taught me a lot, just in terms of how he interacted with people. Mark Roden's a tremendous leader, ran Ding, and I was just blown away by his. Again, integrity was fundamental to Mark. It just lived and breathed it. You know? Still does. And yeah, that kind of thing, that's what really inspires me. Probably people that I would admire more probably are calmer than me. You know,
I do.
I wear my heart in my sleeve. I'm very passionate. It doesn't take long to get me going.
Thanks for chatting to us today on Life and Leadership out here in the, looking out across at the estuary here in Malahide from Malahide Rugby Club. Ray Nolan, as always, it's a pleasure.
Such a pleasure, Bobby. Great
Cheers.
To you. Thank you.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.